This broadcast of Moby Lives Radio is brought to you by The New Press, publishers of And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey by Studs Terkel, a collection of Terkel's famous interviews with musicians ranging from Janis Joplin to Louis Armstrong to Leonard Bernstein, available at bookstores now.
Intergalactic headquarters of Melville House Publishing in Hoboken, New Jersey, aka the Left Bank of New York City, it's Moby Lives Radio.
Greetings, Earthlings. It's the 1st of April in 2006. That's right. It's April Fool's Day. I'm your April Fool. I'm Dennis Johnson. On today's show, we'll be talking to poet Elliot Katz about his late friend and mentor, Allen Ginsberg. The 9th anniversary of Ginsberg's death is coming up this week, but most poets are ignoring it in favor of celebrating any one of several anniversaries related to the poet's greatest poem, Howl. We'll be talking about Howl, its importance, its history, and what Ginsberg himself thought of it. But first, here's some news from the book world. The Borders bookstore chain has announced it will not carry the next issue of Free Inquiry magazine, which costs $5.95 an issue, by the way, because it contains some of the now infamous Danish cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. A spokesman for Borders and its Walden Books stores explained, quote, "We don't want to be killed." The magazine's editor, Paul Kurtz, said Free Inquiry was running the cartoons because they provide a lesson in the importance of political satire and the right of freedom of expression. Kurtz said, quote, "To refuse to distribute a publication because of fear of vigilante violence is to undermine freedom of the press, so vital to our democracy," close quote. A Borders spokesman said the chain had taken a vote, and they decided, quote, "We don't want to be killed." A lawsuit over the cover art on Thomas Friedman's best-selling book, The World is Flat, has been settled. Artist Ed Miracle sued Friedman's publisher, Farrar, Straus, Giroux, because the book's original cover used a painting of his that Miracle said they did not have the right to use. The painting, which depicted two sailboats sailing over the edge of a flat earth, had been a favorite of Friedman's, according to a report on the Book Standard, and the author suggested that his publisher use it. FSG, in turn, thought it had properly obtained permission from a firm claiming control of the copyright, but Miracle disputed that ownership. FSG immediately pulled the cover and substituted another, but Miracle sued them for copyright infringement anyway. The case was in a U.S. District Court in New York City when, suddenly, it wasn't. No one's commenting, but it was apparently settled out of court. Well, cool Britannia. Britannia rules the brainwaves. After the U.K.'s Office for Standards and Education released a report saying geography was the most poorly taught subject in British schools, the country's school minister, Lord Adonis, I'm not making that up, announced that part of the plan to combat the problem was going to be to make a book by Michael Palin of Monty Python fame, Required Reading. Yes, the man who transformed the teaching of history by writing the line, "No one expected the Spanish Inquisition," has now been officially canonized, according to an AP Wire story. The book in question is a travel book called Himalaya, which is about Palin's 1,800-mile, six-month trek through the Himalayas. It's a capper of several major journeys Palin has undertaken, several of which turned into documentaries he made for the BBC. Palin, who has also written a novel, said, quote, "You can travel the seas, poles, and deserts and see nothing. To really understand the world, you need to get under the skin of the people and places. In other words, learn about geography. I can't imagine a better subject more relevant in schools." On a sad note, one of Ireland's most prominent fiction writers, John McGahern, has died in Dublin of cancer. McGoohan's first novel, The Dark, a book about adolescent sexuality, was banned by Irish censors in 1965. The controversy cost him his job as a teacher. He relocated to London, where he became what an Agence France-Presse wire story calls a building laborer. He later moved to the United States and came back from his difficulties to publish a series of acclaimed novels, including Amongst Women and The Pornographer. He had recently earned great acclaim for his first book of nonfiction, his memoir, which was called simply Memoir. John McGoohan was, quote, one of Ireland's finest writers ever, said Prime Minister Bertie Ahern upon learning of the writer's death. John McGoohan was 71. And the great science fiction writer Stanislaw Lem has died in his hometown of Krakow, Poland, of heart disease. Lem, the author of books such as Solaris and His Master's Voice, was one of the most popular and translated authors in the world. He quit writing sci-fi in 1989 after the fall of communism and, as a Reuters Wire story reported, he devoted himself to reports on near-future predictions for governments and organizations, as well as on the technical and ethical problems presented by the Internet. Stanislaw Lem was 84. And finally, Nobel laureate V.S. Naipaul honored the dead himself this week by speaking freely about his love for some historic British writers. For example, he noted that he considered Henry James to be, quote, the worst writer in the world. Thomas Hardy, he said, is, quote, unbearable. And Dickens suffered from, he said, repetitiveness. On a roll now, he recalled reading a Jane Austen novel and asking himself, what am I doing with this material? Here am I, a grown man, reading about this terrible, vapid woman and her so-called love life. Naipaul, who made the news most recently for explaining how he didn't like James Joyce either, also complained that he wasn't appreciated at home. Even though he's been awarded England's most prestigious literary prize, the Booker, and even been knighted by the Queen, the 73-year-old author complained that, quote, England has not appreciated or acknowledged the work I have done, close quote. Well, V.S., whose fault is that? And I'm Dennis Johnson. That's This Week in the News.
It's Saturday, April 1st, and here's a look at the week ahead in literary history. On April Fool's Day in 1857, original Melville House author Herman Melville's novel The Confidence Man was published, and the entire span of the story takes place on April Fool's Day. Sunday is April 2nd, and on that day in 1836, Charles Dickens married Catherine Hogarth, with whom he subsequently had 10 children. He was indeed a very prolific author. And Monday, April 3rd, is the anniversary of the notorious and doomed marriage of F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald. Tuesday, April 4th, is the birthday of Maya Angelou, who was born in 1918 in St. Louis, Missouri. Happy birthday, Ms. Angelou. Wednesday is April 5th, and on that day in 1856, it was the birthday of political leader, educator, and author Booker T. Washington. Born in slavery as Booker Taliaferro, Washington became the first leader of Tuskegee University, and his autobiography, Up From Slavery, first published in 1901, is still widely read today. Thursday is April 6th, and on that date in 1895, Oscar Wilde was arrested in England for sodomy. He had failed to prove his libel case against the Marquis of Queensberry. The Marquis had accused Wilde of having an affair with his son. Wilde lost the suit and was sentenced to 2 years of hard labor. While in jail, he said, "If this is how Queen Victoria treats her prisoners, then she doesn't deserve to have any." Friday is April 7th, and the 7th was the birthday in 1770 of poet William Wordsworth. Wordsworth, working closely with his friend Samuel Taylor Coleridge, launched the Romantic movement with their collaboration, Lyrical Ballads with a Few Other Poems, published in 1798. The book sold out within 2 years, and the author's preface to the second edition became an important manifesto for Romantic poetry. A movement was born. By the time he reached middle age, Wordsworth had become a sensation. His poetry collections were bestsellers, and tourists from London would take day trips up to the Lake District just to catch a glimpse of the great man through the window of his house. Saturday, April 8th, is the anniversary of the first publication of J.D. Salinger's beautiful story For Esme with Love and Squalor in the New Yorker magazine in 1950. The story was to become the centerpiece in Salinger's famous collection about the Glass family, 9 Short Stories. And I'm Valerie Marians, and that's this week in literary history. I know my chicken. You got to know you're a chicken.
I have Elliot Katz on the line. Elliot is a poet and a former associate of the late Allen Ginsberg. Elliot, welcome to Moby Lives Radio.
Hello, Dennis. Thank you for having me on today.
I wanted to talk to you about, coming up this week on April 5th, it's the 9th anniversary of the death of Allen Ginsberg, but rather than there being any kind of sad memorial, there is a rather raucous, years-long celebration going on of his greatest work, the poem Howl. First of all, what is the actual anniversary of the poem? It seems like the party's been going on for 2 years.
Yeah, well, let me say first that it is the 9th anniversary of his death coming up on April 5th, and we do really miss Alan. I certainly miss him personally, but I think during these crazy Bush years, Alan's voice of sanity and his political vision is very sorely missed and would be really helpful to have around. Luckily, we do still have his writings and his voice on recording, so in a way, Alan is still with us. In terms of Hal was written in over a period of from 1955 to 1956, so that it was first read in October 1955 at a gallery in San Francisco called the Six Gallery, so that there were celebrations beginning in October of 2005 around the 50th year with people either reading Hal or doing reenactments of the Six Gallery reading, celebrating it, duplicating the reading as much as possible.
That was a big deal, that event. All the stars of the beat scene were there, were they not?
Yeah, well, many of them were certainly there. You know, Kerouac was in the audience. Michael McClure was one of the readers. And the reading of Hal, if you actually, there isn't, as far as we know, there isn't a recording of that first reading of Hal at the Six Gallery. But there are early recordings from soon after that. And you can tell from the audible audience reaction, the oohs and ahs and the laughter, that the poem astonished even those people in the audience who were familiar with Alan's poetry up until that time. And it really, both because of its language and its content, really opened up and changed American poetry and really American culture and politics too.
Well, what was his stature at the time of that first reading? Was he a particularly well-known poet at that moment?
No. I think in general, to say somebody is a well-known poet is an oxymoron.
Well, granted, okay.
Alan was, became one of the few exceptions to that, but that wouldn't have been true before that time. That reading became extremely influential, so he was certainly far more well-known after that reading. And after the reading, he received a note from Lawrence Ferlinghetti at City Lights offering to publish his book, which included that poem. So when the book came out, that also increased the number of people who knew his work.
So how much time elapsed between that event, the reading, and the publication of
the
poem?
Well, the reading was October 55, And he finished the poem in 56, and I think the book came out in, I think it was late 56. I'm not sure about that.
So the poem, but, as he read it at the Sixth Gallery, was not finished yet?
No, the poem, I think he read the first two sections of the poem at the Sixth Gallery, and then he added a third section and a footnote.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the things that increased the fame of the poem and the renown of the poem was that the government tried to stop its publication. It was printed overseas, and the customs office tried to stop it from being brought in. So there was a very famous trial.
Mm-hmm.
And as usually happens when a free speech is censored, it only makes more people curious about why the government's tried to stop this from being heard.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poem sort of took on a broader life after that.
And when was the court case?
When was the court case?
Was it right around the time of the publication, or was it after the publication?
It was when the books were coming over.
Mm-hmm.
The printed books were coming over.
Mm-hmm.
It was stopped. So I don't really know the dates of the mm-hmm. court case.
And I take it he won.
What?
I take it he won.
They won.
Okay.
And actually, one thing that's coming up, there are many things coming up for the poem's 50th anniversary, and it is being celebrated through 2006 as well, that 50th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's coming up is City Lights is publishing a book about the trial that will include the transcripts
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
of the trial and introductions and, you know, notes about why that trial was so precedent-setting.
And you mentioned City Lights, Lawrence Ferlinghetti's great independent press coming out of his bookstore of the same name in San Francisco. Was this their first book? It was certainly their most famous book.
As I recall, it was City Lights Pocket Poets #4.
#4.
So
their fourth book was a smash hit.
The fourth book certainly put City Lights as a publisher on the poetry map.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me that Ginsberg was presenting portions of the poem as he worked on it. Was that unusual for him? Was he trying things out on the audience, or what did that mean that he did that?
I think as a poet, you're always trying things out on the audience. You know, you write maybe what you think is a completed poem, but as you begin to read it, both in the reading of it in your own voice and in listening to the audience response, you rethink the poem, and that's sort of one way that you go through the revision process.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, Allen was very famous for this line: "First thought, best thought."
Mm-hmm.
And what he really, and one thing he really appreciated, was getting this spontaneous energy of the original idea behind the poem
mm-hmm.
on the page, and not tampering too much with that original energy. But that didn't mean that he didn't think you should ever go back and actually revise the poem.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very beautiful book, which is usually called The Annotated How,
mm-hmm.
that HarperCollins put out, which actually contains a photocopy of the 17 or so drafts that the poem went through.
Mm-hmm.
So you can really see Allen working through the poem, including taking the lines from a kind of William Carlos Williams, a cascading line form
mm-hmm.
to the long lines of Hal
mm-hmm.
that eventually we know as the final version of Hal, and that were those long, energetic lines that were so influential in opening up the poetic line in American poetry. And it was translated, it's been translated into so many languages that poem really is one of the most influential poems internationally
mm-hmm.
of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, indeed, that seems to be the flagship piece of writing for the entire Beat movement, even perhaps more influential than Kerouac's On the Road. But you speak very eloquently to what was so important about the poem. It was also simply the emergence of the poet upon the scene. Now, you knew Ginsberg personally. I believe you became acquainted with him as a student of poetry, no?
Yes. I can. Let me just say one last thing about the poem.
Sure.
In addition to its influence in terms of the energetic and surprising language of the poem,
mm-hmm.
it also came during an important moment. It brought up these personal and political questions during a social atmosphere that included McCarthyism.
Sure.
And it really captured the social ills and the oppositional energies of its time mm-hmm. in a very brilliant new way. And Alan then adding, of course, his personal poetry skills and his imagination really amplified those energies for future generations. It really captured the existential frustration mm-hmm. that young people were feeling at the time, and sort of, you know, through the poem helped to envision the idea that young people might become sort of a new countercultural community to help address the social ills.
Right.
And personal searching for a more welcoming world that people, that Alan and his friends were feeling.
Well, and you raise a great point about just the context. He was, the reading in 55 would have been just months after the final hearings held in Congress by Senator McCarthy, the kind of tail end of the Red Hunt, but also a period of blacklisting of writers, particularly of writers in California, where Ginsberg was at that time. A moment when lots of artists and writers were facing persecution, when the culture was becoming very repressive. Yeah. Maybe reminiscent of the current moment. I can understand why you think that
he is. A moment when there was a lot of pressure toward political and cultural conformity.
Mm-hmm.
That is very much one of the reasons why Hal and its Moloch section and its expression of solidarity in the third section, I'm with you.
Yeah.
In Rockland for Carl Solomon.
That kind of repression.
Very much, the many. We're not living in that same kind of era right now, but there are a lot of similarities.
Right.
And those similarities certainly are one of the reasons that poem seems so relevant still, 50 years later.
Yeah. The howl itself seems to be a howl against conformity. And the great pressure of that moment,
and also a searching for how people might obtain more mm-hmm. fulfilling personal mm-hmm. lives, and mm-hmm. how we might create political change,
mm-hmm.
Create a more humane world. One of the things that I write, there's a new book that came out that's just come out called "The Poem That Changed America: Hal 50 Years Later,"
mm-hmm.
edited by Jason Schindler and put out by Farrar, Straus & Giroux,
mm-hmm.
and it just came out last week. And actually, I have a long essay in it called "Radical Eyes: Political Poetics and Hal."
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I say in it is that I think it's fair to say that what has resonated most in the minds and imagination of readers across the planet for over half a century has been the keen sense that here is a poet devoting considerable literary skills and talents to help envision and create a more humane world. And I think so. I think it's more than just a protest in the poem. There's also this searching for at least hints of possible ways out.
Yeah.
So it was both digging through the curtains of denial of the culture of the time, and also trying to figure out how we might get to a better place.
Yeah.
Through the poetic imagination, through both looking at the world and through the poetic imagination.
I want to ask you again
yes.
about the man himself, and did you, you had a close personal acquaintance with him, spent a lot of time with him, he worked on your poems with you,
yeah.
and just a lot of social time together. I want to ask you if you ever spoke to him about this poem in particular.
I'm sure I did a little bit, but not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Alan was a teacher and friend.
Mm-hmm.
I'd actually met Alan in the fall of 1976. My friend Danny Schott and Danny and I eventually started Longshot Literary Magazine together. We were in a class at Rutgers
mm-hmm.
on the Beat Tradition in American Literature.
The Beat Tradition in American Literature. Yeah.
Taught by by a graduate student named Bob Campbell. It was a great class.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan was actually coming to Rutgers to read one night,
mm-hmm.
and Danny and I were sitting on our front porch on Gilden Street in New Brunswick, and a taxi cab pulled over to the sidewalk across the street, and we hadn't realized that our next, our across the street neighbor was actually organizing the night's event, and the taxi cab pulled over in the afternoon, and Alan got out of the cab and started unloading boxes from the cab's trunk. So there it was, seeing, you know, this poet whose work I admired so much in a cab right across the street. Mm-hmm. So we went out and helped him unload boxes, and they turned out to be boxes of his father Lewis's manuscripts. His father was a well-published lyric poet himself, mm-hmm. and Lewis's manuscripts had been stored at the Rutgers Library for a while. Mm-hmm. So here Alan was taking his father's boxes back mm-hmm. from the Rutgers Library. And actually, after the reading, my friend Kevin Hayes, who was the organizer of the night, asked me if I would drive Alan back to his apartment in New York. Mm-hmm. So we drove Alan back, and he gave us a beautiful automobile tour of the historic East Village, showing us places where activists and writers had lived and worked. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things he told us along the ride was that he actually tried to answer all of his mail at that time, mm-hmm. which I thought was incredibly generous for somebody who was certainly a really busy guy. And Danny and I took that opportunity, and we each sent him some of our earliest poems, and you know, he sent Danny back a great postcard that I actually quote in this new essay I have. But he also, he took about 10 lines of the poem that I sent him, and did some cross-outs and some suggestions to make the poem stronger and clearer, and, mm-hmm. and suggested reading a couple of books by William Cross Williams, Charles Reznikoff, and Ezra Pound. And mm-hmm. So actually, Alan really gave me my first poetry lesson mm-hmm. Through that. I never forgot the generosity of somebody taking that kind of time to help a poet, a young poet he had just barely met. Mm-hmm. And then actually, 4 years later, after I'd been writing for 4 years, in the summer of 1980, I went to Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, mm-hmm. and did an apprenticeship with him for a month, and took a course of his on Blake, where I helped him transcribe his manuscripts, and he gave me advice about my poetry, mm-hmm. and I also helped him open and answer correspondence, which, you know, so I really got to see mm-hmm. the wide range of issues he was helping people with. Mm-hmm. And after that, Alan came down to New Brunswick a year or two later and read at Rutgers and donated a portion of his reading fee to help Danny and I start Long Shot, mm-hmm. this literary journal. And he just was...
he was generous in more ways than one, it sounds like.
Yeah. Financially, he also when I met him, my poems weren't very good, but I think he kind of enjoyed my activist instincts and the fact that I was a New Jersey poet mm-hmm. who had studied with Alicia Ostreicher, whose edition of William Blake's poems Alan was using to study Blake himself. Mm-hmm. And a couple years later, in 1982, I did a young poet's midnight reading during a Kerouac celebration at Naropa, and Alan saw that my poetry had improved and grew supportive of my work for, you know, the next 15 years of his life. He wrote an introduction for my first book and mm-hmm. was going to write one for my second, which actually helped mm-hmm. Convince Coffee House Press to publish my second book, Unlocking the Exits. And it was just a really great, smart, kind, generous teacher and friend from the time I knew him, for the last 20 years of his life that I knew him.
You have written a poem for Alan called Elegy for Alan. I was wondering if we could close out our discussion by having you read some of that to us.
Sure. Let me, it's kind of a long poem, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the beginning and the end of it.
Okay.
So it's called Elegy for Alan. And it was written just a few days after Alan passed away in April 1997. Alan, you gave America a new shape, and now you've lost yours. What a long accomplished road it was, from the bridge or Patterson Falls, through San Francisco's Sixth Gallery, Prague's May King, Pentagon exorcisms, Mid-America's Iron Horse, Chicago 68, Jessora Road, Rolling Thunder, Rocky Flats, cosmopolitan greetings from NYC's East 12th Street. To heaven, the bardo, a grasshopper, a gray void, the place where all things wise and fair descend, the end of suffering, wherever you are, the most curious place in the universe. Yesterday, in your new Lower East Side loft, I held a clear plastic bag with your ashes inside. Fine, off-white powder, only a few bone fragments visible. Boxed inside last Buddhist shrine. Oh, those armor-piercing eyes will look out tender photogenic skull no more. What happens to us? When did we begin taking this trip from energetic body-soul beings traveling the world for democratic freedoms and dream-forged poetries to old-age liver cancer bodies lying softly on hospital cots near busy city windows, searching one last glimpse of old friends and sidewalk lovers, devoting life's last energies to finding new ways to breathe? Why the hell did we accept this ancient bargain? When did we sign this horrific contract for a few mere decades of joy? Well, you were always discovering a new breath, a new spiritus, a no-money-down person-to-person compassion. Now millions across the globe are chanting Om in your honor. Now you've joined Shelley's Children of Light, become a portion of the loveliness which once your presence made more so. But Alan, how you hung in there, how you gave them hell over four decades, how you bowled over house critics piercing thy innocent breast, how you practiced sanity, candor, intelligence, kindness, and boundless imagination as your weapons, how you mixed humor and information, utopian yearnings and minute particulars, how you extended and subverted literary traditions in the most interesting ways and never tired of formal inventiveness, how you revealed the Academy's shower curtain secret, poetry could be relevant to our lives, how you taught all nations youth to dig through the deadwood of exploitation and hypocrisy, how you were expelled from Prague and erased off primetime radio, how you showed that a lone human voice, well-honed and courageous, could challenge a multinational corporate bureaucracy, how you became an unacknowledged democratic conscience of Cold War America. Oh, Alan, you finally joined Walt's side amid the enduring dead. How can that be all bad? Now you can forget daily terrors, quit worrying which nation's elected leader the CIA will topple during new terms of presidential denial, which activist friends will be jailed, which youthful heads will bleed from Tompkins Square, Chicago, L.A., Moscow, Peking, police nightstick, where landlords' eviction armies will helicopter next. Like William Blake's Los, you gave form to human error, Moloch, the heavy judge, plutonium's devouring ghost lingering a quarter million years, unchecked capital skeleton sweeping homeless off the street. Now it's up to those with flesh on bones to tame our monsters inside and out, to carry your sexy wheel of syllables into peaceful battle for the next millennium. Death's phantom steeds have taken one more wondrous singer, one more sweetest, wisest soul of all our days and lands, to who knows where. Praised be the cosmic mystery. Extolled the enlightened fire which outlives the initial spark. Exalted the echo which rebounds through the universe. Blessed be these tears, the tears on cheeks of millions who touched your soft hands, your glowing aura, your living voice, your inked page, your Shambhala coffin. Alan, you tired your heart, lungs, liver, running up a zillion flights of creaky lower Manhattan stairs. I don't know what happens after death, just that whatever's been written is wrong. Wherever you are now, I hope it has an elevator.
Elliot Katz, thank you for coming on Mobilis Radio.
Thank you, Dennis.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to our guest, Elliot Katz, who spoke to us from his home in Brooklyn. And thanks, as usual, to the staff here at Melville House. That would be our engineer, Andrew Steinmetz, our reporter/editors, Becky Kramer and Kelly Burdick, and our publisher, Valerie Marians. We'll be back next week. We hope you will, too. Until then, don't forget, that whale is out there, man.
Thank you.